We do not have a quorum as yet, but I would like to get started. One of the things I just call your attention to has to do with the information in your packet entitled the Fiscal Analysis Department, and it is from Bill Marks, and these are the responses to questions that were asked during the January 24th hearing. So you may want to review that information so that you're up to speed on those questions that were presented, and we didn't have the time in the committee to get that done. And Bill Marks has gotten us a written piece of information to keep us updated on those questions. In addition, there will be two reports, the first of which is vitally important to the state of Minnesota, out of the two, and that will be on jobs and economic development and opportunities. And we'll get that in just a minute or two. And the second hearing that we're going to have is on public safety, finance, and we're going to have an overview in regard to the various aspects of that program as well. I would like to first of all then refer to the jobs and economic opportunities, and you have that before you. And the presenter is Ron Soderberg from the House Fiscal Staff. So, Ron, welcome to the committee, and if you'd state your name for the record, we'll begin with the testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman and members, I'm Ron Soderberg. I staff the Jobs and Economic Opportunity Policy and Finance Committee here in the House, and today I'm going to just be giving you a brief overview of the committee, a look at the accounts of the different agencies that we have in the committee, and just kind of so that you can get an appreciation when the bill comes before you, what's inside the bill when it comes in a couple of months. I'm going to be working off of this handout, Mr. Chair members. It's if you turn to page 2, Mr. Chair members, what you'll see is just kind of an overview of the accounts and the kinds of dollars that these particular agencies are looking at being appropriated for the 2006-2007 biennium. As with all charts, Mr. Chairman, a lot of the story is not in the numbers themselves, but it's kind of in the history of this particular, these accounts. When I first started with this committee back 6 years ago, this is my seventh year, my fourth biennium, there were several other accounts but in the committee, but through mergers and eliminations, several are gone these days. Two of the major items that have happened is there was a merger, two agencies were merged when Deed was created, the one on the top line there. That used to be the Department of Trade and Economic Development and also the Department of Economic Security. A second major merger was the Department of Commerce. The Department of Public Service was folded into the Department of Commerce here about 3 or 4 years ago. And likewise, several accounts are no longer funded by the state. The Minnesota World Trade Center, used to be funded. They no longer exist. The Board of Boxing, the Labor Interpretive Center, and a couple other ones are the Minnesota Technology Incorporated and the Humanities Commission. So there's been a lot of history with this particular committee, and I just wanted to let you know that a lot of the things you see today are the results of 6 years' worth of decisions that the legislature has made in the last three bienniums. But let's go on to the chart.
Mr. Soderberg?
Yes.
Before you leave that, what has been the impact or the result of that combining those various agencies?
Well,
what has the result been?
Mr. Chair, members, of course, one of the reasons for doing that was to get some administrative efficiencies and savings. The result is about, well, with Commerce, it's over $1 million a year with that merger. And I think the same is true with the Department of with Deed, with the two mergers of Trade and Economic Development and Department of Economic Security. And there was also some, you know, policy reasons for the mergers. With Deed, it was trying to bridge our efforts in economic development with our efforts in workforce training and the like. So it was. Those are the major results.
Okay. Thank you. And then continue.
The dollar amounts show just the all funds that these in for the old 607 biennium. As you can see, the total is about $5 billion, just over $5 billion. And the accounts themselves are 17 accounts, and I will go through, I could go through all of them, but this just gives you an appreciation of the kinds of budgets that each of the accounts have. Moving on to page 3, this gives you a pie chart of how the accounts break out. As you can see, one of the major changes that occurred this year is the Department of Human Services became under the jurisdiction, under the Jobs and Economic Opportunity Committee. And that really basically doubled the committee size in terms of dollar amounts. We went from about a little bit over, as you can see, it's 50%. Another major account, of course, is Deed. And you can see on the side, the major agency of percentages of the total funds in this particular committee.
Mr. Sutterberger, would you just hold up? We have a quorum, and I'd like to get that settled before you continue in your presentation. You have before you, members, the minutes of the previous meeting on Monday, February 21st. Are there any additions or corrections? A motion then is in order. Representative Biskins moves the minutes of the meeting on Monday, February 21st. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those assigned, same sign, no. They are adopted. Mr. Soderberg, would you continue? Your Representative Biskins.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Before we move much further ahead, I just have a question of Mr. Soderberg. Mr. Soderberg, on page 2, the page 2 chart, under the second column, the title is FYI 2006-2007 All Funds. I guess I'm inquiring as to where that number came from. Is Jobs and Economic Opportunity Committee done with their work for the session, or I guess I don't know where how this all fits in. So if you could explain that a little bit.
Mr. Soderberg?
Sure. Mr. Chairman, Representative Biskins, that number is, those numbers are the base numbers in the forecast for 06-07. They do not reflect any change items that the governor is recommending or not. But what it is current law. And it includes both direct and non-direct appropriations. And I will be getting into it a little bit more. I think it will probably give you a better appreciation of where the number comes from. But what that is from the forecast in November. And this is the base numbers that we'll be working off in our budgets for the 06-07 biennium.
And to follow up, Representative Biskins.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Soderberg, there are some areas in this budget that grow and or don't grow automatically depending upon forecasts.
Mr. Soderberg?
Mr. Chairman, we do have five forecasted areas, mainly in department, or all of them in the Department of Human Services.
Okay. Thank you, Mr.
Chairman. And as we get through that, I'll go into that maybe a little bit more and give you an appreciation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. Well, would you continue with your testimony then, Mr. Soderberg?
Mr. Chairman, I'm going to be moving on to page 4 now. This is another look at the committee, and now we're looking at just the general fund. And again, it's the base numbers. And it gives you an appreciation of how the committee is structured and how each of the agencies, the major agencies at least, make up the general fund base of this committee. I think It's obvious that more than three-fourths of the committee for general fund is in Department of Human Services. The other ones are deed at 6.9%, housing finance just over 5%, and you can read the others. And the all other categories are those not listed, but it gives you depreciation. Moving on to page 5, Mr. Chairman, is just a different look at one more time. And this gets a little bit to Representative Diskin's question. Now what we're looking at is how the committee's $5.08 billion budget breaks out between direct appropriations for the general fund, direct appropriations for other funds, and non-direct appropriations, which are the open and statutory appropriations. And you can see about two-thirds of the budget are under the non-direct appropriation. That the difference being that when the bill comes to the committee, you'll see so much dollar amount is appropriated from the general fund for the purpose stated. But much of the appropriations that are done in this committee, as well as all the other committees and finance committees, is done by statute. We have a lot of statutory appropriations. A major portion is the federal funds. They're statutorily appropriated. Likewise, we have a lot of programs that are funded with fees or inspection charges and the like, and what the law will say is that of the money collected for this purpose, that is appropriated to the commissioner of whatever for whatever for the purpose it was collected to begin with. And so that gives you an idea of what you're looking at in that dollar amount. And you can see from the pie chart that a majority. Now what I'm going to show you, Mr. Chairman, is just get you some numbers around these that pie chart. And this is how it breaks out in dollar amounts. And looking at that, the direct appropriations from the general fund, direct and open, about 99 cents on the dollar is direct. We have very few open appropriations for the general fund. The direct appropriation other is largely being driven by TANF funds. About 87% of the direct appropriations of other funds is TANF. Workers' comp fund represents about 9%. This is the money that's directly appropriated to the Department of Labor and Industry to run the program, and also includes some money for the Workers' Comp Court of Appeals and a little bit of money for Department of Commerce for fraud prevention and investigations.
Mr. Soderbergh?
Yes.
In regard to workers' comp, what percentage of that total appropriation is administrative costs? And what percent goes to the worker? Do you have that information?
Mr. Chairman, I don't have it. I think I don't. I do maybe, Judge. Excuse me, Mr. Chairman.
Well, if you don't have it, I would like to just.
Mr. Chairman, I can tell you this. I'll give you the
okay.
Comments. About $177,000 or $1 million goes to workers' benefits.
Okay, and then what is the total? Then can I assume? Can you give me the total amount? Of the fund, so to speak, and if 177 goes to the workers, what percent or what number for administration costs? Do you have that?
I don't have that with me, Mr.
Okay, maybe you could get that to me. If
would
you do
me?
Okay, thank you. Continue on that, please.
Mr. Chairman, I've lost my place here. I was on the non-direct funds. Sorry about that. Another 3% comes out of the Workforce Development Fund, and those are directly appropriated. The big box on the right-hand column there, as far as the non-direct funds. And just like I said before, is open appropriations that are non-general fund and statutory appropriations. Of that total, about 60%, about $1.95 million, is federal funds. These agencies receive a lot of federal funds. In fact, if you were to add the federal funds in this box with the TANF, which is also federal funds, for every dollar that these agencies receive in state general fund, there's $1.80 in federal funds. Now, I'm not trying to equate that there's a match of any kind. There is in some cases, but it just gives you kind of an idea of the volume of monies that are involved. A second major portion of that box on the right-hand side of the $3.24 million is the Public Facilities Authority. That's right around $600 million for the biennium. That includes the Public Facilities Authority account, the drinking water, and also the Transportation Revolving Fund account. Another substantial portion are the special revenues, which are statutorily appropriated. That's about 7%, representing just over $220 million. And the Workers' Comp Fund, which we were just talking about, now we're talking just about the statutorily appropriated portion of that, is about $163 million, and it's about 5%. And the miscellaneous is the other 9%. The next table I'm going to be working off is on page 7. As is often the case, the parts are never like the whole, and this is certainly the case in this committee as well. Now what we're looking at is each individual account, and we're looking at how much of their base funding going into 06-07 is from the general fund, both direct and open, direct other funds, and also the non-direct appropriated funds. And as you can see, and underneath it is a percentage of each as it represents the total. And again, you can just see that, I'll just go through a couple just so you can get a sense of what we're talking about. Of the $1,190,000,000 in deed, for example, in the non-direct appropriated funds, the PFA is, again, a very big part of that. It's 50%. Federal funds represent about 40%, at $480,000. The Workforce Development Fund, in this case, this is for the Dislocated Worker Program, is about $54 million. The special revenue is about $41 million of that. The open appropriations or the other funds are almost exclusively from the Workforce Development Fund. But I think you can get a sense of each of those. And I'm not going to go through it, but again, you can see what everyone does. The other one I would mention is the Department of Human Services. As I mentioned earlier, this is the first year that this account has been with the Jobs and Economic Opportunity Committee. This is just the Children's and Economic Assistance Grants and Management portion of the agency. And you can see it's about $2.5 billion. And that shows you that the direct appropriations from the general fund are about $1 billion. The $444 million is almost all TANF, and the $1 billion in non-direct is about 83% federal funds. Finally, Mr. Chairman, I just want to give you a very brief, I realize that, just get an idea of what the governor's budget means to these accounts. This first chart is looking at all funds again.
Now you're on page 8.
Page 8, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, very, very good.
The governor's recommendations are almost exclusively with the general fund. There's a little bit in the Workforce Development Fund, but it... If you look at the base funds for these agencies, as in the November forecast, and you look at what the governor's recommending, it's about 3 cents on every dollar that's from the base. And if you turn to page 10, it'll show you by agency what the governor's recommendations mean. Again, we're looking at all funds here. and the total is about $146 million, and it's about, as I said, it's about 3 cents, a little less, it's 2.9%. Now, I want to caution everyone that, of course, as you well know, that a lot of things can look different depending on how you look at things. And then these numbers are, for some programs, it's a lot bigger than 3 cents on the dollar. In fact, for some programs, it's 100% reduction. But I just does give you a sense, at least, of what the governor's recommendations. The next one is looking at the general fund. Again, we're working off of the base of $1.3 billion. And you can see that the governor's recommendations, as I mentioned, were almost exclusively in the general fund, and I'm working on page 10. And it's about 11.5% off the base. And if you turn it over to page 11, you can see how that number translates as a percentage of the base, general fund base of the committees as in the November forecast. And you can see it. Now, the last thing I want to do, Mr. Chairman, is also in your book or in your handouts today. I'll let you, everyone, if anybody has any questions, I'll let you take a look at it for a minute and just get a feel for it.
Okay, why don't you begin then?
Mr. Chairman, as is always the case, depending on what you're looking at and how it's presented, things can look much different. And when I spoke in front of our own committee about the governor's, in detail about the governor's recommendations, one of the questions was, the base includes forecasted items. And to the extent that they were forecasted, they may not be in this year's current law or in this year's biennium. And so what I brought along today is another paper, and this one is the Jobs and it's the Money Matters paper, Jobs. And on the front of that, you'll see a table that looks at it differently. Does everybody find it? It's in the handout?
Yeah.
And now you're looking at, how does the governor's recommendations relate to this committee's accounts under the current biennium versus looking forward to the next biennium? On column 3 is the percentage changes. You'll see the column 1 is the current biennium, the 04 biennium. Column 2 is the base, November base, going for 06-07. Column 3 is the governor's recommendations for each of these accounts for the general fund. Column 4 shows you the percentage changes between the accounts, between the 04 and the 06 bienniums. And column 5 is the one we just talked about. Now, obviously, when you do any of these, you get some kind of major, let's just say some freakish-looking results. For example, if you look at Deed, you're going to see that the governor's rec between rec for 06-07 versus the forecast for 04-05 is minus 32.5%. A large reason for that is that one of the things that was done last year by the legislature is that Explore Minnesota Tourism, which used to be Indeed, was made into its own entity, was created as a separate entity. And so the Deed number includes the first year of Explore Minnesota Tourism in the 04-05 biennium. And now it's out in the 06-07, and you can see what can happen with numbers. And I present this just so that people can see two things. You really need to know what's inside the numbers to be able to realize what the real number means. And the other thing is that the 04-05 numbers, indeed, is a lot of one-time appropriations. You may recall we did some flood relief for the Roseau area in that bill in 04. We also had a bioscience partnership between the Mayo Clinic and the University of Minnesota, which was one time for a couple million dollars. So I just want people to understand. And that's also true for the Board of Barbers and Cosmetologists. When you see 69% increase, understand that the large reason for that is that they were combined in the second year of the 04-05 biennium, and now in 06 you see the two-year results of that combination.
Mr. Soderberg, yes. Have a Representative Biskin, you have a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Soderberg, under the base column, the word base has an asterisk after it. I can't find where that is explained.
Mr. Schoenberg? I'm not really sure how that happened either. This was formatted to put into our money matters, but I think what it is that the base is the November forecast, which would have been the November forecast is the base, so that people understand where the numbers came from.
Representative Viskins?
No, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Continue on then.
Mr. Chairman, that's it?
That's it. Okay, are there any questions from the members? Seeing... Okay, Representative Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Soderbergh, you always do such a good job. I just wanted to ask you one quick question. Did you by any chance keep track of the, what I've taken to call broken promises in terms of the cuts that were made last year? They were going to be a one-time cut or last biennium, and now they're actually continued on to the next biennium. And I just think it's important for people to know what this division is facing with that kind of dynamic. And do you have a, can you go through that for us briefly?
Mr. Soderbergh?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Clark, I think that there's probably two major items that are driving some substantial numbers in the governor's budget. If you go to page 7 of the handout that I was just talking to, and you look at the chart, you'll see that the $61,644,000 of the governor's change item, the chart in the middle of that page, and also the $12,175,000. I think that those numbers are being driven by what the governor's recommendation that the child care reimbursement rates be frozen. In 06, 07, they were frozen in 04, 05, and they're being, the governor's recommending that that freeze continue in 06, 07, both those numbers. The other major number on that page is the $50 million that you'll see under Children's and Community Services, and that is another, reflects another recommendation wherein the governor is recommending that the projects of regional significance, which were created in the 03, legislature, and were not funded. That particular initiative was not funded in 04-05, and current law would have that be funded in 06-07, and the governor is recommending that those not be funded in 06-07. So I think those are probably the ones you're talking about, Representative Clark.
Mr. Chair, in each case...
Representative Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In each case, the governor is using the language again, oh, we're just going to delay it. Isn't that correct? It's a, that's what he said. The previous biennium is going to be frozen or cut and delayed, and then the same language is being used again. Is that correct?
Mr. Soderbergh?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I haven't seen the governor's bill, so I can't tell you exactly what the language will look like, Representative Clark. With the child care reimbursements, the governor's recommendation is that they be frozen for 06-07 as they were in 04-05, and then in 08-09, they would be. What am I trying to? What word am I trying to think of?
Restored.
Well, not restored. It's that they would reflect inflation. So, in other words, they would be adjusted to reflect CPI, consumer price index. So the base would be what it was in 07, and then there would be the consumer price index would be the way they would be adjusted in 08-09.
Okay. Any other representative, Clark?
Just a total number that you could have from those two, if you wouldn't mind.
Mr. Soderbergh?
For the total for those two particular initiatives?
Yeah, that we can do at least those two. Yeah.
Well, Mr. Chairman, the number for child care is about $70 million, and you'll notice the number here is about 73.7. The reason is for another part, well, there's two things that are happening inside this numbers. One is that the governor is recommending that TANF monies to the tune of about $9.8 million be used for child care, the MFIP child care. So that would restore a little bit of the governor's recommendation here. And the $12.175 million, that reflects really the reduction there is $18 million because what they've done is they've taken some special revenue funds, which is now statutorily appropriated, and it's being recommended that they be moved into the general fund and become directly appropriated. So the total together is about $70 million. The other one is $50 million. So you're looking at about $120 million on those two items.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, if I could just put on, I think it's a, we should probably all take our highlighters whenever it says it's a one-time shift or a delay or whatever and keep track of it, because it turns out, at least with the current governor and the current situation, these aren't turning into one-time shifts at all. They're ongoing, and I we should just be tracking that.
Okay, thank you. Are there any other questions? Thank you, Mr. Soderberg, and your testimony was appreciated. Next. Mr. Soderberg, just hold on. We've got one other question. Representative Otremba, I'm sorry I didn't call on you sooner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
It deals with the child care grants and the stories we've heard because of it. Can you tell me the reason for cutting specifically those programs so heavily and not the others?
Mr. Soderberg?
Mr. Chairman, I really can't comment to that. I'm not sure. I just know that that was a recommendation made by the governor.
And a follow-up,
well,
Representative?
Mr. Chair, and I realize this isn't you're not the one that drew up the budget, but we also noticed last year when we were looking at these child care grants, regionally there were some inequities, and does he allow for those inequities in here, or is...
Mr. Soderberg?
Mr. Chairman, I really can't speak to that. I'm anxious to see the language, and maybe we can make... We'll have a better idea when we see the governor's language. As you know, the details usually is where you can answer those kinds of questions.
Okay, Representative Rukavina.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Soderberger, maybe Representative Gutchard can help me out, but you know, on page 2 of your handout here for jobs, economic opportunities, and all the finance, where the Minnesota Youth Program and Youth Build, I see where youth intervention was transferred to public safety, but were those other two programs totally eliminated?
Mr. Soderberg?
Mr. Chairman, the Minnesota Youth Program, as you know, is the old summer youth program. They receive, in addition to the general fund, they receive about over $10 million in federal funds a year for that program. So it wasn't completely eliminated, but for state general fund purposes, it was completely eliminated. Program will be substantially reduced under the governor's budget.
And Mr. Chair,
Representative Rukavina,
Representative Dunter, is this the program that, like our jobs training programs, the youth summer employment would go through our area, JEPTA?
Representative Gunter?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Rukavina, that's correct.
So
a lot of this money came out of dislocated workers' funds. Some of it did. But that's Boys and Girls Club.
I think that's a proposal, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, proposal.
So, Mr. Chair, then...
Mr. Rukavina?
Governor proposing the juvenile delinquent program in its place, or what's he going to be doing from the summer thing?
Representative Gunter?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The governor pointed out very few people are being served by these programs. However, it's Representative Clark's and many other people's belief that they're being served very well. And we're going to have this debate in my committee. I know there are two, if not three, bills to look at maintaining the funding, and they will be heard. However, it's governor's talking points. I asked to see them, and I think Deed is going to get those to me, and I'll be able to know what he thinks, why he thinks so.
And finally, Mr.
Representative Rukavina.
Thank you. And Representative Gunther, probably. The Minnesota Investment Fund, is it... I mean, I think that's a pretty worthwhile program. What's the rural versus metro disbursements of those? Can you tell me, are they pretty much equal, or is that more geared towards greater Minnesota?
Representative Gunther.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Rokovina, it's geared towards greater Minnesota. However, the federal money is still there, And we have in this place infrastructure grants that Senator Langseth put forth that should help take some of that up. So where I would prefer leaving them there, the governor took them away.
So, Mr.
Representative
Chair.
Representative
Rukavina. Hey, Mr. Chair and Representative Gunther, I know you'll fight hard for that because I noticed in the bonding bill when it came through here that we had, you know, $15 million, I believe, or $20 million in biotechnology type grants and for those slumping economies in Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Rochester. And then the greater Minnesota $5 million got cut in this committee in the bonding bill. So now I look at this Minnesota Investment Fund, which is geared towards rural Minnesota. There's nothing left. So I know you don't want us all to be Sherpas like some of the people around here want us to be. So I hope that you're going to fight for that, because it seems that, you know, that's pretty much aimed at us again.
Representative Gunther?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Okavine, I totally support your concerns. And where I can't create money, I can shift money out. I you have to admit that it was not part of the governor's rex or anybody else's that we have rural Minnesota bioscience money. And my roommate, Representative Hamilton's idea to begin with, he says, why are we just leaving this and there? We have bioscience where you live and where I live. You have it in wood products and many other places. We have it in agriculture also. And we did have $5 million there, and Representative Dorman said he would try to restore us to the equal prominence that we had before the cuts.
Mr. Representative Rukavina, one final thing. Did I hear right? You and Representative Hamilton are living together?
Oh, yeah.
How's that working out?
Yeah. You and Gunkey and Hamilton and Gunther.
Okay. All right. Representative Huntley.
Well, Mr. Chairman, just a comment and a note to Representative Gunther. Back to where Representative Otremba was, and that's the child care assistance grants, about $70 million cuts. The children and community services, about $50 million. What this really represents is an undoing of the welfare reform that some of us supported in 96 and 97. And the idea of that welfare reform was to not only get people off the welfare rolls, Representative Gunther, but to also get them out of poverty. What these cuts are doing is taking away their a significant amount of their child care, which helps them stay out of poverty, helps them be in the workforce, and the same for the children and community services. So what the governor is recommending basically is that we undo Governor Carlson's welfare reform, and instead of putting people off the rolls and out of poverty, we're going to force them back on the welfare rolls and back into poverty.
Your turn.
Representative Gunther.
Thank you. I'll try to get all your questions down. Those were phrases, not cuts. However, it's my belief that in Greater Minnesota they truly might have been cuts, because the department's kind of leaning that way. I think we're investigating that. There is a bill to make sure that what happened for Greater Minnesota was a freeze instead of a cut. In the metro area, they were frozen. This means the check is the same size as it was before. However, it was due to have a significant inflation factor that didn't get in tough times like these, so this is why they were frozen. We can't afford them. The same with the shift. That was, as Representative Clark believes, a promise not kept. And, we have every hope and assurance that those things will be funded when we get out of this deficit situation.
Well, okay. Representative Huntley, a final question.
These aren't tough times for Tom Huntley. These are tough times for people trying to get out of poverty and support their kids while they're doing it. And while we're taking away their, in this committee or in your committee, taking away their child care assistance and their community services, in the Health and Human Services Committee, we're kicking people off the health care rolls. So the only way you can get these people off the rolls, out of poverty, is to make sure they have good job training, to make sure they have child care assistance, make sure they have community supports, and make sure that they have health care. and we're taking all those things we should do away from this group of people.
Representative Gunther, a final comment, please.
This is getting to be fun. Representative Huntley, when you're if you're talking about the 35,000 people no longer in Minnesota Care, is that correct?
Mr. Chair, last year's budget kicked 35,000 people off of health care, and this year's the governor's budget proposes 26,788.
Okay.
Representative Gunther?
It's my understanding that the average Minnesota family income today is $30,400 a year, and where I live, it probably is not that big. However, when you look at those single adults and how much they made, they were qualified making substantially more than that. Those are the ones that left the program, and those people that were in poverty that were single adults now qualify for general assistance medical care that they aren't subject to the $10,000 cap, which I don't think really today in today's medicine will take care of two hangnails in the same hand.
Okay. Representative Clark, we have to move on. Representative Huntley, one final comment.
Well, Mr. Chair, they're eligible for general assistance medical care if they spend down to $482 a month if they're a single individual. And I talked to a woman 2 weeks ago. That's going to be what she's going to have to do. She was trying to work. She's going to have to spend down to $482 a month, and she has a $500 mortgage. So you tell me how she's going to live on $82.
Representative Clark.
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to make sure. Representative Rukavina, I had a clear answer to this question because I'm not sure if Mr. Soderbergh heard the whole thing. He was, and you did respond correctly that the Mr. Soderbergh, that the youth intervention program is transferred to the Department of Public Safety, but the other two programs are totally eliminated. They're not transferred anywhere. They're eliminated. So I just want to be clear about that. That's the Youth Build and the Learn to Earn. And one of the things that I would be kind of interested in this committee looking at, and I'm not sure...
I do, too.
I did mention it in on the jobs committee, but, you know, the cost-benefit of what happens when you cut good programs, the cost-benefit of what happens when you take a program that's actually saving the state money by keeping kids out of prison, for example, which the youth programs that are being eliminated do. There's clear evidence that they do. We actually have a state law that requires us, whenever there are these kinds of change items, to report on this to the state. And I would like to maybe ask the chair of this committee if we couldn't start asking the people who are making these proposals from the governor's office, in fact, I guess it would be the agency heads, to actually bring those numbers to us. And I did mention it in the jobs committee, but Representative Gunther, I don't know if you've ever received anything from DEED since we asked for that. That was, for example, looking at the Youth Build program and Learn to Earn program, what they actually save us, the cost-benefit analysis, which they have done. I've actually talked to them. They did it way before it was ever asked for. But we have in statute a requirement on performance. Maybe Mr. Marks could clarify that for people if you have any questions. In 16A, and it does say that performance measures for change items must be submitted. Have we received any performance measures for any of these change items in any department? I mean, I'm kind of talking about ours because I've had the chance to look at these directly and I happen to have some personal knowledge, but is this committee getting any of that information?
Representative Clark, it's my understanding, a quick answer is no. And I have had my assistant here take down that information. We'll see if we can follow up and get that. And share that with us. And then Mr. Soderbergh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd really, really appreciate that if we could.
Yes, and Mr. Soderbergh, I would hope that you will be able to gather that information for us and get that to us. Would that be possible?
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure what information. You talked about Mr.
Yes, about her concern, yes.
I could certainly try my particular, the agencies I work with.
All right.
Expected by colleagues will work with those as well.
Okay, and if you would get that, that would be appreciated. Thank you very much, members. We have to move on. The next item is public safety, and our presenter is going to be Mr. Gary Carter, House Fiscal Analyst. Mr. Carter, would you kindly state your name for the record and then begin your presentation, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, my name is Gary Carter. I'm a fiscal analyst for the Public Safety Policy and Finance Committee. Mr. Chair, basically what I'd like to do here is give you a presentation about, you know, what's in the public safety budget. Also, we're going to do a little comparison to other states. And lastly, we're going to talk about some of the challenges. So we'll start off with the first slide, Mr. Chair, and you see the agencies there that are in the public safety budget. We have the courts. By the way, we're working off of, you have it up here, this packet here, it's public safety ways and means presentation. We have the courts that this committee is responsible for. Also in the Supreme Court, we have civil legal. We have the Court of Appeals under that, the trial courts, the tax courts. Then we have the Peace Officers Board. This is the post board. They regulate law enforcement officers. This is one of our only few, or the few special revenue accounts that we have, is the post board. We have Uniform Laws Commission, the Board of Judicial Standards, the Public Defense Board. Then we also have part of public safety. We have the Homeland Security, Emergency Management, the BCA, Fire Marshal, Gambling and Enforcement, Office of Justice Programs. This is a lot of Office of Justice Programs. They give a lot of grants to different agencies and nonprofits. And part of the other part of public safety that we have are the 9/11 Emergency Services part. We also have the Private Detective Board, the Human Rights Department, the Corrections Department, and Sentencing Guidelines. Since I began here, we lost two of the accounts. We lost the Ombudsman for Corrections and the Crime Victim Ombudsman. Next, you can see the chart. This is the one that Soderbergh also showed, that shows that public safety is 5.2% of the general fund budget. I think if you look at all funds, it's around 4%. And mainly in public safety, it's mainly the general fund budget that we're talking about. There are some federal funds and a few other special revenue funds. Next, I'm going to show you a breakdown of the public safety budget. You can see that the corrections department is the biggest part of the public safety budget. It's at a little over 50%. The courts are 34%. The Board of Public Defense is 6%. Public safety is at 9%. It gives you some idea of how big this is. The next chart, you can see some of the spending down there and what percent of the budget they make up. I also want to point out, I think this is important, especially for members in Ways and Means, that I think this committee is a little different because the accounts are related. And let me give you an example of that. Say you have a new felony that comes into play. You know, what's the impact of that felony? That impact, first of all, will probably be from the sentencing guidelines, where they're going to do a Fed impact that's going to show us, or show the legislature, you know, the number of feds this felony is going to create maybe in our correctional system. Also, corrections will look at that and put a cost to that. They'll also see if there is probation involved, if there's maybe going to be more trials on this issue, so you're going to bring in the public defenders. They're going to be representing a majority of these people. You also have an impact on the courts. The district courts are probably going to have more trials. A felony takes more time than a gross misdemeanor. You may even have an impact on the BCA, part of public safety. You're going to have DNA samples now for convictions. Also, this committee has an impact on the local units of government. You have a jail impact in some cases. You also have a county attorney impact if there's more prosecution. You have probation, which is another local cost. Then the other thing that I should point out is that some of our items generate revenue to the general fund. For example, you have fines. There's fine revenue. You have the surcharges that are out there on fines. You have other fees and you know and items that are associated with that, and they bring in different pots of money to the general fund. For example, the surcharge last year brought in about $36 million. Fine money comes in at around miscellaneous court fines about $22 million. The 20% share of fines brings in about $5.6 million. Okay, we will go to the bottom of that page. It's the public safety spending. And what I did is I took that from 1996-97. That's when the public safety accounts really jived together. Before that, public safety was in another division. But you can see that it was $891 million. The current biennium that we're in, that money has now went up to about over $1.4 billion. That is a 61.3% increase since the 96-97 biennium. This is mainly driven by corrections. And we're going to see some of that later on. The corrections is the one of the fastest growing areas of this budget. Also involves part of the court takeover, where the state has been taking over the local court systems, the state-run system. I also just want to point out that the governor's recommendation for 06 and 07 versus spending this biennium results in about a 16.1% increase. Of that, included in that, even in the forecast items for the Department of Corrections alone, they have about over $71 million. Next, we'll go to page 3 of the handout. I just want to give you a flavor before we get into some of the comparisons of what the crime rates in Minnesota are. How do they compare to the United States as a whole? And I think last week you heard the population rankings. You had that, and just remember this, that Minnesota ranks, I think it's 21st in population. Wisconsin is 20th. Now, the first crime rate is general crimes. This is crimes per 100,000 population. You can see Minnesota ranks at 33rd. Wisconsin is at 37th, Iowa at 35th. North Dakota and South Dakota, they're at the bottom. Next, we have the violent crimes. This is, once again, per 100,000 population. The Minnesota there drops down to 39th as far as the ranking. Just as an average, the nationwide, there are 475 violent crimes per 100,000 population. Minnesota has 262. Next, I just threw in this slide as a... I found this in one of the source books where they compare states. And it says, what's the most dangerous state? And you can see that Nevada is number one. Minnesota ranks 35th as far as in that survey. The number two state was Louisiana. Number three was Arizona. And I want to mention Texas because we're going to be hearing a little bit about that state later on. That was ranked 9th.
So, Mr. Carter, I'm wondering, as you look at these statistics, you know, it's a little bit hard to compare Minnesota with North and South Dakota or even like Iowa because, I mean, we have a major metropolitan area, and I would gather that there is more crime in the metro area per capita than there is in other parts of the state per capita. And these other states, such as North and South Dakota, and maybe even Iowa, don't have a major metro area. Do you have any sense for how we would compare if you took out the metropolitan area, if you looked at just greater Minnesota, or if you took out the metro areas of the state that maybe have the most crime?
Mr. Chair, that's a good question, and I think what I'd like to do is, you know, pursue that. Because we have like a week to do this, but it's a great tool even for us as fiscal analysts because it forces us to learn. Last time I did this, I think it was like 4 or 5 years ago. So we'll see. You know, it keys us up too to try to get a little more information, and we'll try to get some more information on that.
Yeah, I'd appreciate that because I mean, we need to be very cognizant of our metro area too and doing whatever we can to keep crime down there, but, you know, just across the country, any state that has a major metro area, traditionally there's more crime, it seems like, in it. And, I mean, just to compare with our neighboring states, it'd be interesting to try to factor that out and see how they compare.
Sure. And, you know, just by doing this, like I said, it does raise a lot of questions that will need further investigation. Now, I want to get into some comparisons, and the first comparison is on page 4. It's the per capita state government expenditures for justice activities. This includes the police, corrections, judicial and legal services, and you can see that Minnesota ranks fairly low on this one, 44. Per capita is at $150, where the average is $209. Now, the other thing I should point out is that most of the statistics that we have when we're comparing states, they're a couple years old. You'll see that these are the latest from 2002, and that's the latest. In fact, these numbers just came out. Next, we have the per capita local government expenditures for justice activities. Once again, all justice activities. You can see here Minnesota goes up to 17th as far as their ranking is concerned. This is somewhat of a surprise. In fact, I even called the League of Cities on this to get some information, and they were somewhat surprised, too. This one also will need some further investigation. Next, we have the per capita state and local expenditures for justice, and we see Minnesota is 30th in the ranking. We will go to page 5. Here's another somewhat of a surprise. This is the government expenditures, the total expenditures as a percentage for judicial and legal services. Now, this includes the courts, the prosecution, the public defenders, and legal services. Here, Minnesota ranks 16th. You'll see that the next slide talks about, we go into the per capita state and local government expenditures for judicial and legal services. Here we go to the, we're ranked 15th. Just out of comparisons on the first slide, California is number one, New York is number two. On the second slide here for the state and local government, Alaska is number one, California number two.
And Mr. Carter, on that, I mean, when I talk to representatives of some of these groups, I'm told that our judges have a lot more cases than judges in other states. I'm told that our public defenders have a lot more cases per public defender than in other states. How does that square with this? Do we just have a lot more cases per capita in general, or do you have any sense for why that would be?
You know, the legislative auditor did a survey, Mr. Chair, on the courts, and they did find that we were above average, I think, as far as the caseload for the courts. We did some research for the chair, Representative Smith. We found that some areas were a little higher, like civil legal, I think, which is part of this. We were ranked probably number 5 as far as the state dollars that are going in there from the general fund. We also have some statistics, I think, from the public defenders. There was a survey years ago that showed us with a caseload more than the other states. Now, and I think, you know, I'm not sure on this, but I think some states, like in the southern states, may not cover, like, misdemeanor offenses for the public defender. Something, you know, once again, we probably would have to do a little more research on.
Okay. Thank you.
Now, the next one is corrections, and here I want to spend some time with this item because they do make up a little over 50% of our budget, you know, the public safety budget. And I just want to point out this fact, too, that corrections, that in the year 2003, there were 6.9 million of the adult population were incarcerated on probation or on parole. This is about 3.2% of the population, or it's about 1 out of every 32 adults. So we'll see that here that Minnesota, once again, on the first chart, per capita for state and local government expenditures, Minnesota ranks 39. Now you see Wisconsin up there at 9. Wisconsin, in fact, Their fiscal analyst called me 2 years ago to find out how Minnesota was at such a low rate of incarceration. Wisconsin has a fairly high rate of incarceration. They were looking at Minnesota's model for maybe more probation, more people on probation, and they are starting to work on that. Next, we'll go to page 6. This is per capita spending for local government for corrections. Here you'll see Minnesota goes up to 12. Wisconsin, once again, still high too, relatively high at 15. And of course, you know, the other states are smaller states, they are down there. Next slide is the state prison incarceration rate in 2003 per 100,000 population. This, you see that Minnesota here is ranked 49. So we have one of the lower incarceration rates in the nation. Maine is the lowest, and we were at the lowest a couple years ago. We have now went up to 49th, but Maine is at the lowest. They're at the 50th. Louisiana is the top state, and you see the per capita rate, 155, or the average is 430. Minnesota is at 155. Louisiana is at 801 per 100,000. Mississippi is at 768 per 100,000. And also Texas is number 3 for their incarceration rate. Number 4 is Oklahoma. Once again, you see some of the southern states there. Next, you'll see the rate of adults on state probation in 2003. Here you can see that Minnesota is going up. So instead of using the prisons for like what other states are doing, I think Minnesota has always had that philosophy, we're going to use prisons for the most violent offenders. So you can see Minnesota is 4th, has a ranking of 4th. Washington is number 1. New Hampshire is the lowest at, you see the average is 1,862 per 100,000 population. Washington, by the way, has over 3,000, they're close to 4,000 per 100,000 population for probation. New Hampshire has the lowest, they're at 426. Now I want to point out one thing on here. In 2003, 4 states had an increase of 10% or more in their population, in their prison population. The probation population. Kansas was up 17%, Mississippi 15%, Nebraska 12%. Now 19 states showed a decrease. And this was led by Minnesota, which was down 10%. So Minnesota in 2003 had the steepest decline in the probation population. We'll go to page 6, Mr. Chair. Page 7, excuse me. This slide shows the changes in the prison population from 2002 to 2003. Now you can see the percent increase. You can see North Dakota was number 1, but Minnesota was number 2 at a 10.3% increase. 11 states had increases of at least 5%, but also 11 states had decreases. Here this chart will show you that Connecticut had the largest decrease, 4.2%. And we go down New York, 2.8%, Michigan, 2.4%. I'm just going to jump down to the next one, 2001 to 2002. You can see again the Minnesota having an increase of 7.9%, where other states having decreases. I'm going to skip down to the bottom of that page. Overall prison population in 2000 to 2001, or that overall that where that population your average was about 1.1%, 1.2. Minnesota had a 5.9% increase. The next page, it's 99 to 2000, overall prison population increased by 1.3%. Minnesota had a 4.8% increase. Basically, what this is showing you is that Minnesota, even though we have the lowest incarceration rate now, is starting to grow at a faster rate than other states. I also want to point out that the private prisons, this is always an interest to this committee. In 2003, they held 5.7% of all state prisoners and 12.6% of all federal prisoners.
Excuse me, Representative Mariani has a question.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Carger. On the population growth of the last two tables, do you know what that's, whether there's a particular crime that that's attributed to? You often hear, across the country anyway, grumblings around sentencing related to possession of drugs, for instance. Is that what we're looking at here? Is it spread across many different crime indexes? Is it violent crime? Do we know?
Mr. Carter.
Chair, Judge Marianne. I think it is partly drugs that are driving this. Other areas that we have, we put into place longer sentences. People are staying in prison longer. We also added, more sentences, more felonies. For example, the last one was the felony DWI, which, has an impact on our correctional facilities. I think we estimated that 15% of all felony DWI cases the first time, that's four or more, you're going to get a felony, would be going to prison. But drugs are playing, I think, a very large part in that.
Thank you.
Representative Smith.
Mr. Chair, just to add to that, the 10% increase is 800 bed spaces, and I think the largest single factor in the last 3 to 5 years is methamphetamine abuse.
Mr. Carter.
And Mr. Chair, too, we'll go on that. Since 2000 for the private prisons, the federal use of prisoners or for private prisons has gone up about 40%, where the states decreased about 1.8%. Probably some of that has to do with Wisconsin. Wisconsin was housing. They had a huge share of their prisoners in Tennessee and Oklahoma and even here in Minnesota in Appleton. Now they are starting to pull out. They have built new prisons and opened new prisons. They're starting to bring them back into their own state. Here's the interesting thing here is that Texas once again had the most inmates. These figures are they're hard to, believe when we're sitting here at about 8,500, and here you see Texas with 167,000, almost 167,000. California was second with, over 164,000 inmates. And this is in 2003. Minnesota at that time had a prison population of 7,865. Remember, we were talking about the probation numbers. Texas also had a probation population of over 431,000. So, Mr. Chair, my wife said I must have had a bad dream last night because I woke her up. I did have a dream. The dream was that I was the Texas budget director. Just one other point on the Texas situation is in 2003 they did have an increase. Small increase in percentages, but their increase was 4,900 beds. That's over half our population. Okay. The next item we'll just cover is the females. We have seen an increase in females also in our prisons. Now, last year Minnesota went down a little bit, but from 1995 to 2003, the average increase for females nationwide was 4.9%. Minnesota at that time had a 9.1% increase. Overall, from some other statistics, nationwide the number of male prisoners had grown 29%. The number of female prisoners nationwide, 48%. once again, I think what we're seeing here for the females, this is an interesting one because one, I think the past question on the drugs are playing a big part in this thing. Also, the females, the population, it's more costly to incarcerate. You'll see that per diems, when you break it down by facility, that our Shakopee facility has a higher per diem than the male facilities for the most part. I also just over the weekend was reading an interesting article by the Justice Department where they talked about females in prison. Where males, when they go to prison, if they're with their children, they usually will have a caregiver that, you know, the wife or relative will take care of those children. For females, they felt that about 29% of their children will go to foster care, which will also add to the costs of the system.
Mr. Carter, when you're looking at these costs per inmate, is there a correlation to, say, the number of prisoners in a state? I mean, if you've got, you know, tens of thousands of prisoners like a Texas or something, I mean, is there just a economy of scale that takes place that drives down their per diems, or is there no connection to that?
Mr. Chair, I think that is a big correlation. If you have economies of scale, you're going to have lower costs. But also in Minnesota, we have some smaller states that have costs that are below the Minnesota cost. Now, we'll get on. The next slide, we're just going to show you on the last page here.
I'll let you get into that thing. Go ahead.
Yeah, we just want to show you that the increase in correction beds, you know, from 1996 to 2004 in Minnesota increased 69.13%. Now, Minnesota is currently out of bed space here. We are renting about 87 beds in jails. And we also, as of last Friday, I believe we had 194 beds at the private prison in Appleton. Now, we'll get into your question, Mr. Chair, on the prison costs, cost per inmate. From the corrections yearbook, this is once again these are older data because it's when you're comparing other states that Minnesota had an average cost per day of $75.83. The average overall was $62.22. Highest was Alaska at $111.89. And the lowest was Alabama at a little over $26 per day. Now, I know that Corrections has been dropping their per diem from 96 to 04. I think their per diem fell a little over 12%. And Alaska, but some of this, it's hard to do because you have to compare apples to apples. When we called Alaska before, they were also including their capital costs in the per diem. Next, we have the Bureau of Justice Statistics, that next chart. This is probably one of the better ways. They try to compare apples to apples. And they do this survey about every 5 years. 5 years ago, the survey ranked Minnesota number one as far as corrections is concerned. And what they're doing is they're putting in, you know, the per diems, overall per diems, they're putting in the percentage of management costs or the central office costs, and they're also including capital costs in there. So there you can see that Minnesota ranks number four. With the highest was Maine at, and the average was $22,000 per year. The Maine had the highest, $44,379, and the lowest was Alabama. And I guess this is something that probably the committees are going to have to, you know, our publics will have to look at. You know, what should go in a per diem? I think this has been, there's been always some discussion on that. I remember when we first started out, they were doing a facility per diem, basically, and they didn't include the health costs. And I think, Representative Smith, it was either you or Representative Macklin or Murphy in one of my first committees that asked them where the education costs were in this. And they said, well, it's in another, you know, not in the per diem. Well, now they have included that in the per diem when we usually see the per diem for corrections at $76, but it doesn't include the central office or capital costs. So, the last item, some of the issues or what we can say are the challenges here in the system. I think, you know, the methamphetamine is going to have a big impact with prison beds. We just got the first fiscal note on that, and that's going to be about 44 beds. Also, with additional costs for the public defenders and the courts. We also have the sex offender enhancements. This is going to be another relatively large bill for both the Public Safety Committee and this committee to decide on, you know, how much is going to be, are you going to fund this? The sex offender bill, I just want to go over this. The first fiscal note that we received on this, now this is subject to change, but the first degree, there's two parts to this. One is the first degree life sentence provision. This is going to add 40 beds by 2010, has the possibility to go up to about 1,700 beds in 2060. Once again, far out in the future, but if you're aware of that. The indeterminate sentencing part of that, if they're in there for 2 years longer, it's going to be an additional 820 beds. If they are in there for life, which is that small possibility, could range up to a little over 9,000 beds. I think also some of the other challenges are the growth in the correctional area. I mean, we're seeing, you know, the prison population increase. Along with that comes problems. We have more of the elderly in our jails, some of the females in the overall growth in the prison population. And Mr. Chair, I just want to mention too that in your package, you're going to get some information on what the governor's recommendations are, and also something from NCSL where they talked about what some of the states were doing as far as correctional populations, how they were changing. And with that, Mr. Chair, I will stand for any questions.
All right, Representative Greiling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Mr. Carger. Just looking at your last point here under issues, methamphetamine, with the numbers of people that are incarcerated for that going up so astronomically, and then they're serving long sentences and hard to get turned around. But yet I understand that the governor's budget is flat or decreasing for chemical dependency treatment while they're incarcerated. Could you comment on that? Is that accurate, and why is that, and what will that do you think, to recidivism rate?
Mr. Carter.
Your Chair, Representative Railing. I think, first of all, let me just point out that you're right on the meth offenders in state prison. I have here from Corrections in 01, for January 1st of 2001, meth offenders in state prison, we had a number of 139. As of July 1st, 04, that number is now over 1,000. And now the governor he has put money into the meth bill for treatment for corrections. It's for sex offender. You know, I don't know what the consolidated, I take that back, it's for the sex offender. But I don't know, the consolidated treatment fund is in the Department of Human Services, and maybe we can get that information to see if there is a decrease or an increase. But I thought there was an increase for that, for the meth offenders.
Representative Huntley.
Mr. Chair.
Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Greiling, you've got to follow. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Mr. Carter. And by the way, it's Greiling, everybody has trouble with my name. But anyway, I would appreciate that if you could get it to all the committee members, because I understood that the consolidated fund is actually, considering the enhanced number of prisoners, was flat or shrinking based on proportion.
Okay.
Thank you.
Representative Huntley.
Well, Mr. Chair, some of us had no trouble with Representative Greiling's name. It's just her.
Yeah.
But, Mr. Chairman and Mr. Carter.
We won't ask any further questions about that, Representative Huntley.
On your handout, you've got an $8.84 million increase in health services for corrections. What's the base for that? I mean, that's on top of.
Mr. Carter.
Chair, Representative Huntley, I believe the base is somewhere around $32, $33 million. I can get you an exact number.
And, Mr. Chair and Mr. Carter, how much of that is due to the facility that they're building, or won't that show up over the geriatric facility for corrections?
Mr. Carter.
Mr. Chair, Representative Huntley, that is not included in this budget. And, you know, for right now, there will be, I assume, operating costs for that. And I think that will be run by the, correct me if I'm wrong, Department of Human Services.
Well, Mr. Chair, it always amazes me that you can go to prison and get great health care, but if you're out trying to earn a living, it's a little tougher. Yeah.
Mr. Carter, if I can go back to the prison cost question a little bit, is there a, you know, if we tend to incarcerate only the more violent criminals as compared to other states, is that something that tends to affect our per diem too? I mean, are per diem costs higher for states that tend to incarcerate a greater percentage of their population as violent criminals and not?
Mr. Chair, I think you're right on that we do incarcerate more of the violent offenders. And, for example, the per diem at Oak Park Heights, which has the highest, you know, the custody level, let's say, that it has one of the higher per diems in the correction system.
Mr. Carter, have any idea how Alabama gets by with $8,128 a year? I mean, do their prisoners live in tents and forage in the countryside for food, or? Or is it just no dessert?
I think the southern states, they have a lot more offenders, and a lot of them are nonviolent offenders. They my understanding too, there's a lot of dormitories down there. And each state is different. I mean, even, you know, Florida, I think they even, you know, a couple of years ago, they even had a statute in their law saying that the prisons couldn't have air conditioning.
Hey, now we're prisons.
Well, I can make all kinds of fun comments about that, but I don't think I will. Any other questions for Mr. Carter? I'm sorry, Representative Mariani.
Thank you, Mr. Carter. The sex offender enhancements, and I note on the governor's budget, he's got some increases for sex offender treatment. What's been the pattern of our expenditures for treatment over the last, say, decade? Has this been sort of a steady increase? Has it been an up and down kind of thing, or is it a new kind of expenditure for us? In terms of sex offender prevention or treatment, I guess. I'm not quite sure what treatment means, but I imagine it has to do with psychological counseling, conditioning, those kind of things.
Mr. Carter.
Chair Representative Mariani. There has always been a treatment component for sex offenders. This is going to increase it. I don't have the base budget, but I think sex offender treatment is at Lino Lakes Prison and also up at Moose Lake. In fact, they even did that. They're working with the Department of Human Services on a project where they are supplying personnel at Moose Lake for some of the potential, you know, civil commitment people to try to get them into treatment earlier to avoid that civil commitment, that high cost of civil commitment.
And Mr. Chairman,
Representative Mariani,
you don't know what the pattern of this is. Have we been steadily putting more money into this area, or has it been an up and down thing, or flat, or?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Mariani, I can't remember. We'll have to check the base budgets for that, and once again, we can get that information.
Okay.
Too.
Thank you.
All right. Any other questions? Seeing none, thank you, Mr. Carter. Members, I'd like to announce that Judy Zelio from the National Conference of State Legislatures is in the audience. We'll be here in Minnesota until Thursday. Judy, if you'd stand up. And if anyone's got any requests from NCSL or questions for Judy, I'd ask you to seek her out. Members, tomorrow we will also have a Ways and Means Committee meeting. I believe that Representative Dempsey announced it at the start, but it is tomorrow in this room at 2:30 to go over the forecast. I would have liked to have done the forecast today, but the state economist and commissioner are kind of busy today releasing the forecast, so we're doing it tomorrow. With that, members, the meeting is adjourned.